initially I wanted to ask you about Grumpus that's now out.
Oh, Grumpus. Well, yeah, the 20th anniversary Platinum Edition is out on DVD. It looks incredible, and I'm very excited about it because this one won awards when it came out 20 years ago, and it has great reviews from that time. And what we're looking at today is so much better looking and so much better sounding.
It is a DVD with bonus features and outtakes of a filmed 1997 recital you did in London, England.
Yeah, it's actually, I would call it a performance because it's not a recital.
Okay.
I performed all the characters. It's really a storytelling piece that happens to be an epic narrative rhyme. And that combination makes good theater. One of the reviews for Grumpus way back in 1998 when I first released it on VHS,
after the live performance.
In that particular review, I was compared favorably with C.S. Lewis, Lewis Carroll, and J.R.R. Tolkien.
We have a DVD for sale right now of starring you, and here's the deal about this DVD. You've been around so long that even then, either through budget or anticipation, you shot it in digital.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the thing is, you have not had to welcome the digital world bringing you in for transfer mentality. You already were shooting in digital 20 years ago, maybe anticipating a 10 or 20 year release later.
My release was meant to be right away.
Okay, but did you always know the world that you were creating on paper, longhand, and then the typewriter, then the computer? Was this done as a cathartic experience for you, or you couldn't do your rock and roll thing anymore, so you had to think, what else am I going to do? I mean, I know you had the training from the Boston Latin School. You've been in our military. As Ram Dass says, getting older is groovy. You have a 60-year memory bank here to draw on.
Oh, yeah.
Were they always assembled for big screen adaptation? You were doing this before the term DVD was ever invented.
Yes, they were meant to be feature films. These last two projects, Changeling's Return and...
Were they in screenplay form?
They were, and they went out in screenplay form. But they didn't get made. Almost everyone who read Grumpus loved it.
You submitting stuff yourself, or did you have a theatrical agent ever helping you?
I had lawyers who submitted it. I had casting directors who submitted stuff. I mean, I didn't have an agent ever. Still don't. Wouldn't mind having one, by the way, but, you know.
They is. Anyway. I mean, if I was running a studio, I'd say bring this to Disney.
I took it to Disney.
Did you get a meeting?
No, but I got a response.
Okay.
They loved it, but, of course, they were much wiser than the general public. And specifically, the biggest thing I got told time after time was, if it was a bestseller, they would be really interested. So the book had to come first as far as they were concerned because the cost of producing the thing was just too great.
Okay, but you were deeply rooted in folklore and mythology.
Yes.
And it does inform Grumpus and Changeling and a lot of your work.
All of it.
And don't tell me there isn't a commercial market for this right now. So what happened when you, shall we say, reluctantly stepped into the lead singer role? Because I always thought this stuff was created for four or five people to read pieces of. That's the way I always kind of thought it was.
Well, when I did Grumpus, it was.
Were you hesitant
when they first?
I mean, you were wearing 18 hats. Did you really need another 19 hats?
No, I have to tell you how this happened because it's quite funny.
And you can see the results.
Yeah,
they're for sale right now.
I did it.
Yeah,
but the thing is that when I got that letter from the professor saying how I wanted to show that to some friends, and I did. And one of the first friends I showed the letter to said, well, if you're going to go forward with Grumpus, I'll put up $50,000.
Does it really take in history one advocate to jumpstart things sometimes?
In this instant, it definitely was triggered by the professor's letter. Now, Of course, based with a friend saying they'll give me $50,000 if I go forward, I immediately sent the letter to everybody I knew so they could see if I'd get some more interest.
And did your daughter, and of course your long, I would never say long-suffering wife, did they know as they watched this pre-workshop thing, did they catch it?
Well, I have to tell you, Judy's version of this is everybody she ever met who talked about me said how she was so lucky and she should stick by me because I was going to be some big deal. And she got so sick of hearing it because...
Yeah, but you now end up in a room in Pasadena with me.
Well, that's true. That's true. So is this it? Is this where we finally come to?
Yeah, as Peggy Lee would sing, is that all there is? Yes.
Okay. When a group of people got interested, I was interested too. So I said, okay, I might be able to do it live, not me, have it done live, produce it, with a star, some kind of a guy with a TV cue that people would understand. Say, oh, if he's in it, we've got to watch it.
So you were thinking of a traditional routing where there must be a name attached.
There had to be a name attached. Yes. I figured for like $300,000 just for the equipment rentals and stuff, okay. Right? I said, but if there's a name attached, it maybe could go direct to television. I would have preserved the rhyme. It would be done in a medieval setting. Everybody in medieval costume. He'd play the bard. It would be sensational because the story is fabulous. It's a wonderful tale. Mm-hmm. I love it. So I'm out there and I'm trying to find a star because, you know, that's how you make a deal. And my friends say, what are you wasting your time looking for a star? We don't have money for a star. You did the tape. You are the one who sold this whole idea to us with your performance. You perform it. So $3 million they didn't have. That wasn't going to happen. $300,000 they would do. And they came back to me having to perform it. Now, the good news is I had recorded it, and I had recorded it in character voices.
I didn't know that. Okay.
So, well, that's how they got to hear it.
I mean, I know they heard piecemeal stuff and things like that.
So, to learn the piece for this gigantic, enormous gig that I was now being forced into, I could rehearse it with my tape, where I learned it at the same time I learned to change the voice into that character.
Okay, but so, like an athlete changing positions or a passer in a basketball team becoming more of a shooter, is there a mindset or a mental thing you have to go through where you are a reluctant organizer, producer, and of course it's sort of your vision, but all of a sudden you're the lead singer?
I had no fear of stage. I was a rock and roll singer.
Come on, you've been doing it since 1962, whatever it is. Okay.
No, as far as getting up on stage, that was not the terror. The terror was, you know, to do this 88 and a half minute epic narrative rhyme in character in front of an audience on a one-night shoot and get it right.
Like that live black-and-white television in America in the 50s or England.
But the shows weren't that long.
No, they were not. Sometimes they were 15 minutes.
Yeah. So that was terrifying in its own way. Not the doing of it, but the memorizing.
Okay, but that's what... And then you secure funding and you go to England.
Right.
And I could not imagine this thing not being done in England, not because your composer was a British, David Carr, went to the Royal Academy of Music.
Well, he was my arranger, by the
way. Yeah, yeah, right, okay. But I didn't want to see this in the San Fernando Valley or in the New York stage.
Okay. The story itself is about a knight.
Yes.
Okay, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Sent by his king, number two.
Okay.
To combat a ferocious grumpus, which is a giant cat. It's actually very much like a liger today. A real one would be a liger. And so we didn't have knights in America.
No.
We certainly
we don't have
didn't
royalty.
Have a king.
Yes.
Right? So basically it was already set in some place where they spoke English. So it wasn't a German tale.
Did you make earlier efforts to find UK partners?
I did. But I had friends there. Now, the friends were great.
Okay. Okay.
Now, what happened is for this particular adventure, there was also the fact that bardism as an ism, as a thing that actually happened.
Yes, yes, yes.
Before writing, before books, before radio, before television, before recording, the entertainment was either a live musician or a few of them, mm-hmm. or a bard, a storyteller.
Maybe with a drum or a flute or a lute.
But it was
or
a storyteller.
Yeah, yes.
So that tradition was big in the British Isles. It's also big in Scandinavia. They have skalds. Skalds, they call them.
All right, so it ends up in England.
It ends up in England because my native language is English, among other things.
And how do you secure, let alone film, and mount at Blenheim Palace?
Blenheim.
Okay.
Blenheim Palace.
Okay, it's Blenheim Palace. Yes. Okay. Which is part of, it's not quite the White House in America, but it's pretty close.
It might be a little more important.
Yes, because of the history of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, you end up doing this, by the way, with Academy Award attendance like Lynn Redgrave and her mother, Lady Redgrave.
Yeah, they were there. They had several gold medalists from the Olympics there.
Right. So, I mean, you do this in England at one prestigious venue.
Oh, yeah.
What is it like for you preparing it for you know, release, considering it already was shot in digital?
Well, as for digital, the simple answer was that I had a very limited budget.
Mm-hmm.
So film, raw stock processing, all this stuff, and all the big heavy equipment and trying to keep it quiet and everything, and all the space it takes to shoot
yes.
that film was out of the question. The fact that they did have by then good 16mm cameras, but you still had to process the film and go through the same whole routine. They also had good digital cameras, and they were shooting Digibeta, which is a whole lot better than anything that had come before it.
Yes.
It was better than regular tape. So the people who were setting me up in England arranged for the Digibeta system and a truck, and I flew Peter Anderson over, who's... Now he has his Academy Award, too, for his contribution to motion pictures through the years.
Yes.
He's the guy who shot the 360-degree stuff at Disneyland. He
yes.
shot the thing with Captain EO.
Yes,
and
yes.
all that. And that.
Yeah.
He's a good friend of mine. To get it done, the first question I had was, nobody knows me in England. If I'm not a virtual unknown, I'm a complete unknown, one or the other.
Yeah.
How do I get an audience? And a good friend said... He'd been giving that some thought, and he said, I should make an alliance with a charity. Said, oh, okay, do it as a charity benefit. Right. Yeah, what charity?
Okay.
And he said, well, because Grumpus is family friendly, you know, it's a good children's story, do it for Save the Children. So I sent them a tape. They had to hear it. So the same tape that I had given to the professor, they got. And they listened to it, and they liked it. And the next thing I know, I'm being told I have to be vetted by Buckingham Palace.
Yes.
Buckingham Palace? How did this happen? What have I done? How did I get in there? And the answer was that the chairman of the Save the Children Fund is Queen Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
And her daughter, Princess Anne, is the president. And it was Princess Anne who wrote the foreword to the program. That was why. Now, the other thing was it had to be a celebrity venue in order to encourage all these high rollers.
Yes.
So, bucks up, as we say in the movie industry. I had a $300,000 shooting budget. That would have paid for shooting, for capturing.
Right.
But the event had to pay for itself.
Okay.
Which meant that the high rollers would come. They'd buy each seat for £1,000. I'm an expensive act. Anyway, so that was supposed to be the setup. And I had a fellow saying that he was selling tickets and he was selling tables and all this was happening. He turned out to be a liar. He sold nothing. So suddenly I'm there in the UK and I'd already signed a deal with Blenheim Palace. I'd scouted all over the country, mm-hmm. found several lovely places where it could have happened if it wasn't going to be shot. There was no room for camera crews and
right,
lights and all this
right.
stuff. So at one of the meetings with the one place I thought I had lined up that had been turned into a restaurant, which broke my heart, I said, we got to find a venue. And this guy, I'm sure he's a wag, he said, oh, well, the only thing that'll suit you and Grumpus is Blenheim Palace. I said, then why isn't it on my list? So they put it on
okay.
my list. They made an appointment. I went there. And the guy was kind of originally a little distant. He said, you know, Michael Jackson had supposedly rented their chapel for something, and then he never showed up and he never paid. So I'm an American rock guy who's yes. now showing up. Anyway, I got past that, and I was all set up, and I was going to rent Blenheim Palace. My wife took the tour. When she took the tour, the docent said, "Oh, please forgive the horrible mess out on the south facade. They're putting up this theater, and it does pay for the new roof." So I bought the roof for Blenheim Palace.
Okay, so we can now see it on DVD. Well, by the way, I think for anybody listening to this, I do have one question after seeing this DVD. What is the secret of line memorization? I know you wrote it, and I know I've seen The Doors do 20-minute pieces and Bob Dylan do a 14-minute piece, and whatever it is, but this is an hour pretty much of you.
88 and a half minutes.
Oh, thank you. So I ask you about the process or the secret of, shall we say, line memorization. How did you pull this off?
Okay, everybody says, "Well, you had to do it because you wrote it. You know all the words." I say, "Yes, I know all the words. It's the order they go in that's got me freaked."
Right.
So anyway, you have to realize that rhyme is a mnemonic device. It aids memorization. And little children who've heard the rhyme before, if you forget or you change a word, they'll tell you the right word because they remember. Even if they don't know the rhyme, they know what comes at the end because of the rhyme. So it actually was not as difficult to memorize, besides considering that I was a rock and roll singer. I had long sets and lots of music kind of thing. I don't know how many verses I used to know to John Henry. Uh-huh. But, these things can go on forever. And I improvised. Now, not with Grumpus, because you can't. This is it. This is what you're doing. I would say having pre-recorded it and having it to listen to and to talk along with. And I used the old trick in terms of when I was very young, I was doing animation. And to do animation, I'd sit in front of a mirror and make faces until I got the expression I wanted, and then I'd draw it on my character. Well, as I memorized the story from the tape, I also looked at myself in a mirror to see what gestures, what facial expressions or whatever might go with the story. So in a way, I directed myself.
I want to talk about Changeling only because it's like a lot of your stuff. I don't want to call Rachel Carson your Muddy Waters blues influence, but environmental concerns inform a lot of things you do.
Yes. Most seriously, it is the backbone of Changeling's Return.
Well, that's what I want to talk about because I don't have to tell you, but there's been like a lot of scientists, and second warning discussions on environment and global warming. And there's some serious stuff going on right now. Let's just say you forecasted it 10, 20, and 40 years ago. And I think it makes a lot of your work, sadly, even more topical.
I first stumbled into Rachel Carson at the Dudley Street Station on my way to Latin school
Didn't
one morning.
Didn't you pick up on her in 59 or 60?
Yeah, that's what we're saying. Seventh grade.
And did the book and Rachel Carson, who, by the way, took a lot of shit from people,
and also became like the godmother of everything.
I agree, and we know how important her contributions and, Life magazine, I remember all that stuff, but religious factions didn't dig some of her stuff.
No. But I read The Sea Around Us. That was her first book, I think.
Yes.
And I was so depressed after reading that book that the world that I was born into, the world that I saw in the movies, and I saw a lot of movies when I was a kid because of my father being a movie director at WNAC-TV.
Yeah.
So that world was not going to be there for me when I grew up. The oceans might be dead. And by the way, right now we got, radioactivity flowing all through the Pacific.
Please, we.
It very much influenced all my subsequent thinking. Now, I didn't live and die every minute worrying about the environment, but it was always in my head. It was always part of what was going to happen and why I was tuned into
it. And remember, you're not the kind of guy that was going to march in Earth Day, which began in 1970.
I couldn't march. My ankle was
okay,
no good.
But still, ecology mixed with music and rock and roll, you've always had that duality. I mean, there's a character, a guy named Morgan, a rock and roll singer, who sort of saves the world in one of your pieces.
Well, in Changeling, that's what he's brought over for. Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But now let me say something interesting about Changeling. Changeling's Return refers to two things. It was originally Changeling when I began writing it in 1973. It went through a period where it was Morningstone, and I was trying to sell it to
the studios.
And
was the writing process acutely different doing that as opposed to Grumpus?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Compare and contrast them.
Okay. Changeling began as a Faustian rock journey through this psychedelic world of witchcraft and astrology and all that. It was quite popular in 1973. This was, you know, the age of Aquarius and all that business. What's your sign? You couldn't say hello to somebody. You had to find out what their sign was. So it started out as a Faustian accident where a guy trying to make out with a girl is trying to impress her, and she's
some Sergio Diversion Act kind of deal,
yeah,
maybe.
And she's pretending to be, you know, interested, and he's pretending to be a sorcerer, and it works. And that's when they, you know, so that was an interesting little story, a good way to go. And then I entered Cal Poly, and they had a special experimental program that was multidisciplinary thing. And as soon as I got into that, with my multidisciplinary background, it changed what the original Changeling was meant to be from a Faustian modern version musical into a environmental story with enormous impact and importance.
And by the way, it's not lost on me that, and I, maybe this stretches back to elementary school, but you were always sort of well-versed in ancient rituals and traditions and Celtic folklore and the Greco-Roman pantheon. I mean, you've been spieling about that a long time, but you also, your soundtrack has been Little Richard and the Everly Brothers and Chuck Berry and original rock and roll songs that you sang in real clubs and on television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny, Jack Good, who produced the television series Shindig in America in
60. Broke my heart. He broke my heart.
Well, why?
Because I was in the hospital.
Yeah.
And Shindig and Hullabaloo were on the television. And I was watching what should have been my career go by while I was riding in the hospital.
Okay, but I guess
he broke my heart.
Guys are all lucky. I never wanted to be in a rock and roll band, but I still might do it. I think, why not? But here's what I brought up Jack Good, who was a product of Oxford in England. In the 63-64, he had done a early documentary on the Beatles, around the Beatles. Then he comes to America and gives a Shindig for a wonderful year, a live rock and roll television series. I went to some tapings in Hollywood. But Ian Whitcomb, a singer, pop singer, piano player, vaudevillian.
I worked with him once.
Yeah, Ian, who had a big hit in America, You Turn Me On, or in the mid-60s. Him and I were talking about Jack Good on a tribute piece I wrote recently. It's posted on the Ugly Things website. He said Jack Good, a graduate of Oxford, understood the dramatic aspect of rock and roll. He understood Jerry Lee Lewis. He understood rock and roll is theater a little bit, which is why there was funny skits and shtick and live music, often live vocals over pre-recorded tracks in the Shindig series. But you sort of understand the dramatic, the spiritual, the ecological, the folklore, the ethnomusicology, if that's the term. You brought that into your music too.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first band I had in Germany, the first one I played with that was a real band,
yes,
were the Vampiros. Now, the Vampiros had capes hanging from the guitars cut like bat wings, right?
Okay.
And so
you're giving us early goth here.
Yeah, well, who knew it was goth?
Okay, you know? Okay.
Of course, I was in Germany, so.
Okay, maybe. Yes.
Anyway, but they didn't have any songs that went with the capes or anything. So what I did is I said, wait a minute, they're going to do a Bedouin shawl, which is Arabs, and they're going to do a Chungal shawl, which was jungle stuff.
Yes.
I said, okay, we can do all that, but you got to have stuff that kind of goes with it. Don't just stand up there and do, you know, Pretty Woman, which they didn't want out yet, but you don't do Pretty Woman while you're dressed in a vampire suit with a top hat, right?
Even though Roy Orbison has had a theatrical and an operatic aspect to his vocals.
Well, here's for the fun. So I said to him, we need something spooky to go with, you know, the vampire show. And so they didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. So I said, tell you what, let's do. I know a great song. It's called Love Potion Number 9. It's got very spooky. It's got a real nice feel. I can do this thing.
It mentions the gypsy and all that stuff. Yeah, okay.
But it's also, it's the feel of it.
Does it surprise you at all, only because I'm putting on my musicology cap and because I know the principles? The Lieber and Solar songwriting team who wrote the song and produced the original Coasters version of it, but Jerry Lieber, the primary lyricist, was a graduate of Fairfax High School, literally grew up around the corner from where you and your wife lived on Curzon in West Hollywood, just like Santa Monica Boulevard.
Right.
You discovered occult books and stuff like that. These are streets that Jerry in the 50s traveled as they came to L.A. and they were based in New York.
Right.
And they understood some of the same. Well, first of all, there's also an element of sexuality, too.
Oh, yeah. But I loved his stuff because he wrote all those songs for the Coasters. I used to do them when I did covers.
Right. And remember, the Coasters had multi-voice narrative.
Uh-huh.
There was drama.
Yeah.
There was a teenage delinquent charm. I was talking to Jerry Lieber one time, and there's a great Coaster song called Shopping for Clothes. And I said, I love that song. And he said, yeah, I wrote it about a Robert Hall store in L.A. This is a guy, and remember, Mike Stoller is a graduate of Belmont High School, sort of near downtown Los Angeles. Right. So as teenagers, and remember, they did end up writing Jailhouse Rock. So the thing is, you understood classic rock and roll with folklore, drama, theater, part of your stage repertoire. But the thing is, I don't think...
And I also was really good at martial arts, which gave me my dance routines.
Okay, but here's the deal. Getting back to Changeling. And again, I don't want to divert and go too far back, but like Jim Morrison of the Doors, where there was ancient Greek mythology in his work, reptilian vision, snakes, ecology, even the journey through the psyche, as well as ancient symbolism in Egypt and even creatures, you've had to sit here and watch for 10 or 20 years, shall we say, the cinematic climate change, whether it be Harry Potter movies, whether it be Goblin movies, whether it be Blair Witch Project. We've seen a world emerge over 10, 20, 30, and 40 years where the stuff that you were originally submitting, which flipped out a lot of movie studios, is very commercial right now. Not that you were in competition with any of this stuff, but I mean, actually, you're right on point with this stuff. Did you kind of intend to bring in the whole aspect of worship so we would like revisit like ancient pagan gods and idols? Or were you trying to steer us to the responsibilities or our responsibilities of the planet?
Yeah.
I mean, you were laying this stuff out. I didn't catch it initially until I've heard it, seen it on print and investigated it. But I mean, were you actively conscious, like Bob Dylan or Leonard Cohen or any songwriter who thinks maybe big picture, of the multiple dimensionality of all the shit you were throwing at everybody?
Yes, I was aware of it. I did it on purpose. And it's interesting that when you speak of the multidimensionality, it's not only all the hats I wore, which is also part of it. But it wasn't so much that I was trying to get people to convert to ancient paganism. I mean, that's not where I was going. What I was saying is that there was a time. People say to me, okay, Well, you're doing this, and even if we in the West learn it, what good is that to the bushman? I said, the bushman doesn't need it. The bushman lives in the bush. He either lives or dies by the lion's roar or whatever. He doesn't need to be told about the environment. He's alive in it. He's part of it. Whereas we, who buy meat in packages and not ever paying any attention to the animal.
Yes.
And who, you know, turn on a faucet and water comes out. Modern civilization is so interdependent on all the systems that we have. You could knock out L.A. very, very easily. There's never more food in L.A. than would last 1 week. So if the supplies aren't constantly coming, everyone starts to die within a week.
And let's face it, the infrastructures go back so far, like the, what is it called, the Pima Indians helped build navigation devices that we still kind of are dependent on. Or
right.
We understand, we can go back to Aztec, Toltec. There
are aqueducts in Italy that
okay,
still
but, function. But here's what I get also from the changeling. And not because we've just had to deal with Hurricane Katrina and, of course, something sadly close to me, Hurricane Harvey. But in a weird way, not weird meaning good weird, you also put out the premise, and it's documented in a lot of stuff you do, but especially the DVD and the books and the print that bring us the changeling, that some kind of supernatural being is like going to appear and maybe make us get a little more into activism. I mean, is that a foreshadowing device?
On the contrary, my statement is that all these people who are just passing through.
Well, but you do yell God and floods and water. I mean, there's all kinds of elements in this deal.
Yes, but the whole point is there isn't some great supernatural Superman going to show up and fix it.
Okay.
My point is that we should fix it.
Okay, but changelings got folkloric and mythic and history
because
and
occult.
Because those
are the things that used to drive us. Those are the things that were part of our environment. Not just the big environment that we're talking about, but where we lived, what we did, the rituals and expressions that we had. And we have been discarding them left and right,
that's
debunking
what I mean.
Them, all this kind of thing. Saying, and when you do talk to people, it's like, only God is the only one who can solve this. Does that mean we can't do something? Does that mean, are we going to get in trouble if we try to fix it?
Were you encouraged when we started getting into trash disbursement about paper and plastics?
Yes.
I mean, I never thought things would go that far.
No, but they got that far.
I mean, was that encouraging to you?
That was, but there's other things that have backfired, which were things where it was all a big deal that one thing we could do to help the Africans that was starving and suffering
yes.
was we'd go over there and dig wells for their herds.
Yeah.
Great idea. So we ran over there and we dug a well and it would have taken care of all these people. The trouble was that to water the herds had to keep coming to the well. And when they came to the well, little by little, they ate all the vegetation on the way and everything turned to dirt and they had to come further and further and further. And the well served nothing, and the herds died. So it wasn't that it was not a good thing to do. It was that it was not the right thing to do to solve the problem.
Okay. Side trip, though, then.
Okay.
Why don't you propose some ways for us to possibly solve the environmental crisis?
I don't have those answers.
Okay.
Do you do it
as an artist in your work, and that's
part of it? I am a diagnostician. I diagnose them. I don't provide prescriptions.
Meaning you're more educational.
Yes. I try to tell people what was, what is, what was good about what was, and what we should do today in our thinking, to adjust our thinking. There's a couple of lines in what used to be the Lorai was a kind of a gentle,
yes.
touchy-feely piece.
Yes.
That's the one that Mark Roth wanted to do with
yes.
me. Well, in 1992, I rewrote that. And here are the principal rewrite two quatrains. No single horn sounded a warning, but the earth began to buck and the seas to rise toward burning skies on the day the disaster struck. Winter on winter with never a sun, their forests all stripped and bare, their herds all dead, no grain for their bread, a world of dread and despair beyond their most awful imaginings, beyond what their craft could forestall, beyond all the arts of their glorious race, far beyond any reason at all. Then on came war, all blood and gore, pestilence on a famished steed. Death rode triumphant in their wake, and leading them all was greed. Now, that's the kind of thing that I put in some songs. It's also the kind of thing I sometimes did in coffee houses. Okay, but let's be realistic.
You're a guy that's had to deal with the new, happily deal with the new Playwrights Foundation and all this kind of stuff. We understand the theatrical nutrition in your journey. You know, as we again examine Changeling, is it by design or economic reality that it's set or returned in England?
First of all, the folklore surrounding Changeling is all of Western Europe. Basically, a Changeling was believed to be a child left by fairies in place of another.
Okay.
And so when you had a child that was autistic, that was born looking fine, everything about him was fine, but he became strange or didn't develop naturally the way people expected him to, those children were often called changelings. Now, the thing about a changeling was that the changeling replaced the human baby, and the human baby was taken off by the queen of the she into the underworld and never seen again. Now, that's one feeling for changeling. Now, when I say changeling's return, in that story, I don't specify if Morgan is a changeling left in place of another, returning to his roots where he rediscovers himself and returns now knowing he's a changeling with the lesson of life renewed, a la Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, or alternatively, a human, now grown, who is taken into the fairy world, into the world of Morningstone, the land of women, as the Celts would have it, where he is introduced or reintroduced to things that are in his subconscious, that are part of his unconscious, and emerges from that with this knowledge of all these ancient things that make sense that he can now use to develop. Because when he comes back, he's not the guy he was when he went in. He now has a purpose and a meaning to his life.
Okay, that's a key term. As you look back at your body of work, what is your purpose on this cockamamie planet? To be a storyteller? To be a thinker? To reveal and heal? I mean, I will say one thing. I think if you have one problem, and I'm being comical about it, you've never sunk, if that's the term, to a quickie sexual aspect of your work, any kind of kink. You go into scarier possibilities than any sex could be, as far as challenge and dark and the light and all that sort of stuff. But surely as you have prepared these two recent projects, coupled with your ongoing series of teaching and layout design and books and the titles with your publishing company and things we've done together, I mean, are you doing what you are supposed to have been doing since you were age 12? Are you a Pied Piper? I mean, I am disappointed Hollywood didn't roll out the red carpet to you because I've seen the impact of these things on, I wouldn't write intros to books if I didn't thought they had something to say. And I take a look at some of the star-driven movies and stuff, and I understand you need that celebrity to put the fannies in the seats. Mm-hmm. But surely, I always thought you'd be the king of getting development deals, and people would really nurture and develop your stuff. Now, what you've done is you've done it all yourself, funding, preparation, and on some interesting independent force nature, you own everything now, and you are the income stream and the distributor and the producer and the mounter and the exhibitionist and everything. We get it. But what have you learned about yourself with these projects, because before we kind of finish up and really spend a bunch of time on the steps that got you here, what are you doing? What have you done? What have you found out about yourself from these things?
For reasons unbeknownst to me, but I have always had a sense of responsibility. And this sense of responsibility is, if given these gifts, if they are gifts, or curses, if you prefer, of creative juices, then right now I don't have to do another thing. Our retirement is good enough. I don't have to work. I don't have to do anything. But I do have to finish my work.
Why have you bled for this stuff?
Because to me, it's the reason why I'm here. This is what I'm here for. I have a huge project I'm about to undergo, and if I finish it, wonderful. If I don't, if I die during it, that's the end of that. I'm out of it. I don't have to worry about it anymore. And I have another one behind that. Now, I'm 73. I'm not getting any younger. You know, you can't be 50 years ago doing this and still only be 21.
It's what Graham Nash told me when I saw him do a lecture on his autobiography at the Grammy Museum. He said, I'm age 74, how much time do I have got left? Time to get this stuff out.
Exactly.
And he also wanted his children and his grandchildren to know who their father was. Your daughter has known who you are the whole time because she has applauded some of these things.
Oh, yeah.
She's been a focus group for you.
She has. She has.
And I do want to talk about some of your music stuff, too, because it's the other door to your life, which at once was dormant, has widely opened.
Again, yeah.
With rock and roll stuff, reissues, original masters you've had. We'll get to that. But I think I want to just spend a bunch more time, and I think we've covered a lot of stuff here. But you don't preach religion in your work.
I do not.
There are people like, you know, Edith Hamilton, who discusses, you know, comparative religion. And we know about Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung about the influences of archetypes and myths. And there's also William H. McNeil, who really kind of edited some classical Mediterranean world thing, I seem to remember. I mean, these have been early kind of compass guides for you.
Yes, because from what we know of the world, and we're always discovering that there's stuff that goes back even further than we thought. We keep finding new treasures, unearthing new things.
As Leroy Jones, who became a Mary Baraka, once famously said in front of me at the California Museum of African American History, if anybody tells you to run it down, you tell them to run it all the way back.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That has really stuck with me.
I have been tuned into these things since my earliest memories. And I think part of it may be what Jung called racial memory or something. It's not racial, but racial as in human race.
But he also talked about cleaning out your psychic closet.
Yes, but we have also discovered that chickens, when they see a shadow, they know to hide.
They bail.
You're right. They know to hide because these things are instinctive. And what we do know now, this is a recent discovery, although I've known it all my life, is we remember things from before we were born. That doesn't mean necessarily that we lived a past life. It might be that these are things that are passed on to us in our genes.
Okay, but you know, when I view your DVD products and I read some of your books and I listen to some of your music that are, shall we call, companion items, I'm not quite aware that you might have read Robert Graves, you know, White Goddess, the historical grammar, the, you know, poetic myth. The one thing you always had going for you, because it's becoming an economic stream now and an artistic product, and maybe the movie studios or maybe some of the record labels pre-video understood this, you are inherently, I'm a child of Hollywood biologically and regionally. Mm-hmm. You're a child of film, simply because your dad goes back to the 30s and 40s and 50s as a distributor and a filmmaker. And you met John F. Kennedy in your home and all that kind of stuff. But they're inherently cinematic, all the things you do, from the scripts on the page to the descriptive aspect. Yeah. I mean, that's not lost on me. And then, I mean, why wasn't every animation studio not knocking on your door?
Well, I have to say something very clear.
Am I getting close on some stuff here?
This is cute. Adam and I, my baby brother, who's recording us now.
Yeah.
And he's not a baby by any stretch of the imagination anymore. He's just 20.
I am blown away. There's 18-year difference between you.
22.
Yeah, I like that situation of a mother 22 years later saying, "Here I am again." I don't really see that too often.
No, but what I love about it is I even wrote her a thank you note. I said, "Thanks, Ma, for this great."
I mean, you're
brother.
Already in college, and your mother says, "Guess what?"
Yeah,
that's I like that.
Well, actually, I was in the military, but same thing. Okay, so. The thing is, when I was doing the songs with Adam, I would describe them cinematically, and he'd say, "Yeah, but we're not seeing the pictures, we're just hearing the music." But the imagery, to me, underscores the music. I mean, I and by the way, Jim Morrison went to film school.
Yes,
and Jim Morrison was accused or celebrated for that same thing. He had a cinematic approach to his songs.
Yes.
Well, so do I. Mm-hmm. Actually, Jim Morrison and I maybe have a lot more in common than I ever knew.
Well, he also sang and wrote a tune called The Changeling.
Yes, which is also, that was a mind blower. I didn't know that. I do know that he played the tea party in Boston.
He did.
And I had the tea party, my band, which is not the same as the venue.
Unlike the musicians that I've interviewed, or the tunesmiths, or the poets... you're a guy that, you come out of rock and roll, i.e. Little Richard playing in Germany when the Beatles were in Germany in Hamburg. You've done enough rock and roll clubs, especially back east in Massachusetts.
Well, that was universal. Out here it was clubs.
Back but the thing is, you're not, I don't think you're a failed rock and roll music guy that went into theater. Mm-hmm. I think the theater preceded your music thing.
The theater was always one of my horrors. My dream was always that somebody would cast me in something that I'm supposed to do every night, which by itself is a horror, to have to repeat it over and over and
okay,
over.
Okay,
the other one was that I'd forget.
Okay.
I'd get out on stage and they'd look at me and it was my turn, what do I do?
While we're here, we might as well, we'll call it the duality. But it's really not a duality, and I hate being narrow cast and put into boxes by people. But while you're mounting and distributing these catalog items, although there's a lot of new information, and Dr. James Cushing of the Cal Poly San Luis Obispo English and Literature Department often has said to me, because I had some... It wasn't problems. I was getting drafted to do a lot of books on 60s and 70s musicians. I was never reluctant. That's just because it happened to be an area that I'm quite good at. And he'd say, your stuff really works. Keep going. Do more. Do more. And I said, I don't want to get into an oldies or a nostalgia bag. And he said to me, it's not nostalgia if you're delivering new pop culture information. And I know when I do these books, they're unlike all the previous books on these subjects. Mm-hmm. And it's not nostalgia, because I think it's good to talk to people 20, 30, 40, and 50 years after a fact and not do revisionist history, but have them talk to them. Like I talked to Robbie Robertson of the band. I interviewed him in 1975 and I interviewed him in 2016. I like 40 years later seeing somebody and continuing the narrative. Mm-hmm. How this applies to you, there are records and music and independently released singles that go back to 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67 that you once wrote and recorded, and some didn't come out, some did. Some were soundtracks to a couple of movies. And what has happened a half a century later is these things are finding an audience in Europe and England and airplay on satellite radio and record labels calling from England to license and lease master recordings from you. And all of a sudden I'm reading articles on you in English magazines like Shindig, and you're doing podcasts for Goldmine Magazine, and you've been on Open Mind Collectibles internet radio show. And the thing is, here you are at 72 or 73, having to talk about yourself at 22 and 23 and 24 and 25, but you are in control of your own legacy and catalog. So tell me, what is this trip like that, thankfully, this is not happening posthumously for you?
It would be difficult.
But you know, I really, really want to talk about this because you have new product coming out, or shall we say remastered versions of things you've done. You have unreleased catalog, some done with your brother Adam. You have original soundtrack items that have been remastered, but you have singles that are on auction markets that people are seeking.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this is just, to me as a record collector geek and a fanboy and whoever I am, you can't define Harvey Kubernick.
Can't define me either.
No. But as Dennis Dragon, the beloved Dennis Dragon, used to say, we can't define it, we just do it. But still, shifting gears here, your music is finding a new home in fanzines, real media, ads that have been either given to you or you've purchased. Whatever it is, there's a new world of people that you're not an oldies act. This is like music done that is now being heard for the first time. And you're not a casualty, or you're not some has-been guy in the music business and let's go reissue something. It's a parallel career, but it's not really a career. You just do it. But explain the records and the music and what's out, what's coming out, and just tell me, what is it like when all of a sudden you're getting queries on stuff that goes back before the Beatles came to America?
Well, that's rather a shock and a pleasant surprise, and that's very nice. But more to the point, I think, is that all of the stuff that I've done recently, the new recordings, starting in 2013,
yes,
with my brother Adam,
yes,
are also informed by his tremendous skills and talent. And I listen to...
And let's face it, there's two categories on the menu here. There's the post-2013 collaborations with Adam Studio, mixing, overdubbing, producing, yeah, here. But I'm also referring, going way back, yes, pre-Adam involvement too.
Absolutely.
There's two different apples and oranges going on
but
here.
Take as an example, Gray Day Lady.
Okay.
Gray Day Lady is a piece I used to do in coffee houses back in 1966 and on. And it's finger picking, and I sing. And that's all it ever was back in those days. Now, when we started re-recording my back catalog, that was one of the ones I really wanted to do because it's a great kind of a feel for it. It's a good piece. And so I came in and I had to get my ancient old arthritic hands to play the damn guitar again the way that it had to sound. And I played it again and again and again until my fingers were bleeding in order to make sure I had at least enough of a take to put it together and make the thing. And then when I was done and I sang the song and I had played the song with all of the finger picking and a little bit of strumming in between, Adam sat down and he installed the Adam mode into it. And that provided keyboard, and that provided bass, and that provided drums. And that took it out of my coffee house into maybe not a piano bar, but a...
The new retail world.
The new retail world. And by the way, the thing that I have noticed is when he did it, I liked it. In other words, we'd do something, and if I liked it, I approve it. We go on to the next
thing. But this isn't an Everly Brothers thing of harmonies together.
Well, we did a little of that, too.
Okay, but is it a mind meld thing? Is it a sibling thing? Or is it just two people that are on the same page together?
We're definitely on the same page. And it's definitely a lot of it, I think, is mind meld, and quite possibly because we're related. Then we both have rock and roll DNA. You know?
Yes.
And he studied music. I studied some music, okay. But he studied more. And he's a hell of an engineer and all of these things. Now, what I find is that I'm listening to Grey Day Lady, and all of a sudden what I'm listening to is the piano. And I'm listening to the way he played that. Or I'm listening to... what is it called? You Got What I Need.
Yes.
Heavy Duty Rocker, right? Well, we didn't...
Does that have horns on it?
No.
But I heard something with horns.
Oh, rock and roll.
Yeah.
With
the
sax.
Yeah.
I mean, that is killer. And we brought in two ringers on
but
that
also,
one.
You were taking germs of songs or demos of songs or fragments of songs or completed songs that were in a drawer.
Oh, yeah.
For decades.
Decades and decades.
And did you feel the impulse that these needed to they could be contemporary, or you had these things sitting here, or you're just a songwriter and you thought, you know, they're not really back catalog, they're kind of things that never went to fruition.
What happened is, as I'm getting older, my daughter, who's a fan, is going to miss the songs. My wife, who is my beloved,
who deserves a purple medal.
But the point is, both of them kind of got on me and said, you know, if you don't do these now, they're lost forever. They're gone. And of course, the joke was, and besides, I need to pay for the grandchildren's college education, so I better do something that makes money. So anyway, we started recording them, mostly sort of for the vault. You record them so they'll be there, whatever could happen would happen. But as I recorded them with Adam, I wasn't hearing stuff you stick in a vault for somebody else to do later. I started hearing some performances that were in and of themselves ready for release. These were masters. Some of them were great masters. Others could have been better, but they certainly were better than average filler. So if you now have an album, for example, with six potential hit-type songs on it, my God, that was almost unheard of. It used to be an album could be triggered by a single song.
And a bunch of filler or whatever.
Yeah. As I listened to my back catalog as produced with Adam.
Yes.
It was obvious that we're dealing with masters. And so the question was,
shall
we release them?
So then let's finish up and dissect or examine recordings you did in the 63 to 66 era that had some regional distribution back east, either on your own label or little labels picked up, or they ended up being songs in movies that are now on DVDs like Demo Derby and things like that. But it's fascinating, and maybe the word isn't fascinating. Maybe it's just part of the whole gestalt.
Three of my musical pieces ended up in movies. Demo Derby, it was arranged by Arthur Korb, performed by the Rondells.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it before I went to Germany. I didn't play on it. I never saw the movie until long after it played across the country with the Beatles.
Yeah, it was the movie that ran as the opening feature in a theatrical run of the Beatles' A Hard Day's Night in North America.
Yeah, and a lot of
theaters. 300-500 screens, maybe?
No, it was over 6,000, some say 8,000 screens.
Right, because it was your secondary feature on Hard Day's Night.
And it could rotate quickly.
And let me tell you something, folks. If you don't believe me, there's actually some newspaper clippings of people standing in line.
Okay, then Feeling Good, I put 10 songs in that movie. And
right.
I performed 8 of them. Two of them were performed by the Montclairs. There were 12 in all, one of them being Gershwin's Summertime. They also performed by the Montclairs.
Okay.
And one that was written by an English folk singer, and she sang her own song. It was called Ride the Rainbow. But I had 10 songs in that movie. One of the songs never put
into
anything.
Is that 65 or 66? 64-ish?
We recorded them in 65 and 66 and released the film in 1966.
What studio did you do those things in?
My father's.
Right.
In his studio in Watertown.
And did other people use your father's studio of noted...
No, it wasn't for rent. He did things for other people in his studio. He was a producer.
And let me tell you something. I think it's important to mention that he did theatrical films, but he also did industrial shorts and stuff.
He did a lot of industrials. He did a lot of commercials. He did a bunch of politicals.
Well, here's the deal. Some of our first footage of John F. Kennedy pre-president, mm-hmm. your dad he was a friend of the Kennedys when John Kennedy was a congressman in Massachusetts.
He shot the stuff down in Hyannis Port, a lot of it. The other movie that my stuff got into was The Second Gun, about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy.
I mean, this is what I find, first of all, I'm beginning to realize, as Andrew Lew Goldham, the record producer and author, has said, there are no accidents. This is not about connecting the dots exclusively. Only you could be present and actually see John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy in your home or brief sightings as a kid or younger, because your dad is giving the world the first network footage of them for the presidential run of 1960. Mm-hmm. But then years later, you have music, sadly, if that's the term, in a movie that documents the murder of Robert F. Kennedy. Yeah, the book ending of that is...
That was very tough for me.
And by the way, I'm not going to say why did you do it, but how did you do it?
It was, again, serendipity. I went to a Christmas party up on Nichols Canyon, top of Nichols Canyon, invited by the members of the foreign press, who were the first people to welcome
was
me.
Was Mark Marzouk there? Does that name sound familiar to you?
No.
Okay.
But the thing is, I was up at the top of the hill. It was Christmas, and it was the hosts were Germans.
Okay.
So... Yes, I did a couple of Christmas Carol kinds of things. I was.
Were you working in the room in those days?
No, I was.
You weren't. Were you networking?
Yeah, I was networking. I was come to the party, bring me a guitar. You know what I mean?
Okay,
one of those.
I mean, you weren't looking for girls. You were all married and everything.
I had one.
Yeah, this is unusual. Okay.
So anyway, I'm up there. I do with a few songs, and because it's a German household, I have this one song I wrote when I thought I might be going back to Germany. It was really for my German fans, called End of Summer. So I played End of Summer. It's got two verses in German and three verses in English. I played it at that room that day. And yes, the Germans loved it. But Gerard Alkan, who was a member of the underground in World War II, heard the music and he came to me afterwards and he said, that is the zeitgeist of this Jahrhundert. This is it. That song is the zeitgeist, is the spirit of the time. And he wanted it for that movie.
Did he tell you what the movie was about?
Oh, yeah.
And what did you say?
My thing was like, wait a minute, my father did the films for JFK, and now he's assassinated, and now I'm being asked to do the music for the assassination of Bobby
Kennedy. But it wasn't an exploitation film.
No. Now, here's the thing about it. I understood what he said, he loved the music so much. I said, okay. First I said no. And then I said, I'll tell you what I will do. I said, I will not let you use the song, but I will let you use the music without the lyrics.
Okay.
And so that became what we put out there. End of Summer is out again now, and I'm about ready to talk to the Bear Family Record Company in Germany. And I was thinking that what I would probably propose to them was that they do rock and roll, which sounds like my band in Germany in 1964, and End of Summer, which was my song for them afterwards, and release that as a single and see how it flies. And if it flies good, they can then do the multi-set.
Okay, so I want to finish up on a couple things. I want to ask you, your website displays all kinds of items available to hear, purchase. State Records is putting out some stuff on you in early 2018.
Oh, they've put theirs.
Right.
They put theirs.
What do
out.
They have available?
They have Watch Out Woman.
Uh-huh.
And The Way That I Need You. Taken right from the movie strip on the Charles River.
Right.
That's what they put out.
Okay.
Dr. Robert Bailey, Rob Bailey, a DJ.
Yes.
Acquired the rights from me to release another 45.
Right.
The original Travis Pike Tea Party recording of If I Didn't Love You, Girl.
Is that due soon?
That's due soon, but it's next year.
Okay, so that's the 2018 deal.
Yeah.
you have things up for sale of back catalog.
Yeah.
Original pressing kind of stuff.
I love them. I've listened to them since we recorded them. And I hear stuff in them now that I didn't hear before.
I'll tell you what, and this is a general observation, if I'm just a judge on a few hearings of your older stuff. It doesn't apply to the newer stuff because the newer stuff is really a collaboration with Adam and it's post-2013. One of your strengths, and I guess it's you who did it, and I don't know where this came from, but you do know how to range music in the rock genre. I can't imagine what you were like doing Little Richard stuff in Germany. And by the way, in a place where people didn't speak English. And that's a demanding audience at 2 a.m. where you have to do multiple sets.
Yeah, but I got to tell you about the Germans and me. When I got there, I could do Skinny Minnie. I did Skinny Minnie. I remember that. There was a crowd. There was a big room, lots of tables, lots of people. And I come out, and I don't know why I did Skinny Minnie. Maybe because it's one of the songs the band knew.
Yeah.
Right? So we're doing Skinny Minnie. And all the Germans go, boom, boom, boom. They're hammering on the table. They're like, whoa, have I got participation going here?
But did you always knew there was...
They loved me.
But did you always knew some of your songs, even though the ballads and the rockers, there was an aggressive tone. It wasn't wimpy music.
Well, like I say, my rock and roll dancing, my twist sensation was based on martial arts.
Yeah, and so that's what I find it, where you could take it pre-Beatles in America to right now.
Mm-hmm.
There is something about a 60-year journey that it's not remarkable, it's the way it's played out. And I think we live in such an ageist society and in a youth-driven world now. I'd rather talk to somebody 73 than 23. The media has done a lot of us wrong with their priorities. And by the way, I think they haven't made your life easier. Let me ask you one other last question here. I have a book coming out shortly through Cave Hollywood. You did the layout for it.
Yes, and my graphics artist did the cover design.
Okay, how do you, and you've done many books before, and I'm very pleased with the work on the layout here. Is it a different set of muscles when you aren't the artist and you are a guy for hire laying a book out?
Yeah, very much so. Because when I'm laying out my own material, I am very conscious of every nuance and the juxtaposition of things, because I am also into symbolism. So I'm always trying to get it to say not just this and this as two separate things, but to say them in such a way that they complement each other and reveal a third truth. Now, doing the book for Cave Hollywood was very different. You had written the chapters. You had a lot of great photos and things like that, and even, you know, posters and charts and what have you. And they went into the property where they belonged, more or less around what was being said.
Yes.
Excuse me. Which was all very interesting to somebody looking at it, but it's a different kind of a book. In a way, it's a history book. In a way, it's a pop culture book. And so the importance of it is that it be well presented, really well done, spaced properly and all that kind of thing. But I'm not as... So it's a one level detached from what I do for myself. Now, that's not to say that I don't give it everything I know, that I don't put all my skills and talents, if that's what they are, into producing it, but not being intimately involved in its creation, I am able to be a little more hands-off, so that if you or David Kessel want something done differently, that's okay with me. I'm actually working for you and for him on that
book. And you also found us, your longtime graphic designer, cover artist, Linda Snyder, Where did you find her? Because she sure gave me what I wanted.
Way back when I recorded songs from Longren, which is the big deal starting next year for me.
Yes.
The one about the dragon on the Flag of Wales.
Well, yeah,
the Arthurian dragon.
We'll ask. We'll talk a little about it. Okay.
Okay.
Let's save that for the next one. Yeah.
Her husband was one of the singers that David Carr got together to record some songs from Longren.
Okay.
So that's when I met him. Then I had this very big deal where two different companies, unfortunately they hated each other, but who knew that, were coming to fund Longren. I finally had funding for Longren through Cinemedia International.
Yes, yes.
One group was out of Columbia. The other group was out of Fox. And the group from Columbia had just fired Bagelman, and the group from Fox had just hired him. And there were two different groups with two different names that weren't Columbia and Fox. And I threw this big bash to introduce the music. And I had a cake made with the image of the dragon on it. Billy Bryan made a dragon mock-up for me.
Yes.
To put in the corner so everybody could go get that picture taken. You know the new one's fabulous.
Yeah.
He did that one too. Anyway, I got all this stuff together. I invited all the principals so I could let them hear the music and get into the feel and the excitement. I invited a lot of friends. And as soon as they saw who each other was,
walk out.
They both dropped it.
Right.
Now, I tried. I said, okay, well, we definitely won't work with them then. He said, we're not interested.
Did that educate you just how political everything is in this world?
Why didn't I know that I had heard? I knew about the Bagelman scandal. I had no idea that these people were his supporters and those people were the people who kicked him out.
And okay, but you know what? Linda Snyder emerges.
Yes, because she came with her husband, Lonnie, who was one of the singers.
All right.
And Lonnie insisted on introducing me to her because she was a graphic artist, and he thought I'd want to know who she was, and I might want to hire her for stuff. And in those days, she showed me these great brochures of things she'd done for some motorboat company.
Yes, and you just gravitated to her work.
Well, when I started needing a graphics artist that wasn't myself, because I'm not totally unskilled there either.
Yeah.
And somebody who had that experience in advertising and assembling elements in different ways than I would.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit pedantic, mm-hmm. I fear, when it comes to that. I called her. The first thing that I think she did for me was the program for Grumpus. I'd known her for several years.
Okay.
But she did the program for Grumpus. She did a whole bunch of illustrations toward an illustrated manuscript-type book for Grumpus that never happened. Couldn't afford it. And since then, I have called on her many times over the years to assist me with graphics.
And finishing up is that I originally had asked my friend Gary Strobel, who does a lot of work with me, scanning and technological aspects of my books, to do a front cover of a Doors book that I had planned for late summer, fall.
I got you, Linda.
And all of a sudden, he was kind of really booked. You said Linda Snyder should do the cover. And then we were aiming toward a 2017 release. But in my true hippie fashion, I noticed the Doors were putting out a double collection of their singles on the Rhino Warner Music Group. And then just as we were looking at things maybe for Christmas, this week, November 17th, the Doors are issuing a monaural and a stereo version of their second album, People Are Strange. And as being the hippie I am and the collaborative person I am and the mensch that I am, I want the Doors to have this complete 2017. I'm not going to jump on their heat and piggyback a book release on top of that. This book will be announced on December 8th, Jim Morrison's birthday, and the front cover she's working on will be there. And this item will be for sale, I know, the first quarter, if not pretty early part of 2018. And part of the reason I do this is that you do meet new people all the time. And I'm dealing with somebody I've never physically met, but she knows how to work with people.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see that too often.
You have to come to my next solstice party.
Okay.
You want to meet my crew?
What's the food like? The
food is sensational. It is. We put out cold cuts from heaven.
Everybody's married there.
Well, not really.
Okay.
But the ones who aren't probably don't want to be.
Okay.